You probably know at least one person whose last few weeks or months of life was spent in suffering, helplessness, and complete dependency in the final stages of a terminal illness. This is, of course, a bad period for the dying person, but it's a terribly difficult time also for the friends and family who feel helpless and who know that there's no hope for recovery. Rational suicide is one way out of this situation, a way that more people are beginning to discuss. You can think of it as a form of voluntary self-euthanasia. A few months ago on Fresh Air, we discussed rational suicide on Fresh Air. One of the speakers was Morgan Sibbett. He had already helped a friend end his life, a friend who was suffering with Parkinson's disease. He and his wife, Johanna Raphael Sibbett, have drawn up an agreement with one another in which they pledge to help the other end their life if a time should come when the partner is suffering in the final stages of a terminal illness. Morgan Sibbett is mentioned in this month's Philadelphia Magazine article called The Hemlock Covenant, if you've seen it. The Sibbetts are both with me now. They are Quakers who live in the Philadelphia area. Morgan is a retired economist and engineer who frequently worked abroad. He is now 68 years old. Johanna grew up in Holland and came to America at the age of 26. She's been a nursery school teacher and taught for many years at the Rose Valley School. She is 62. Morgan Sibbett, Johanna Sibbett, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to see you.
Morgan, you're involved with rational suicide on the level of it being a social issue of today, but also on a personal level because of the agreement that you've drawn up and because of the friends and acquaintances who you've consulted with and who you've helped in the ending of their own life. What brought you to this issue?
Well, the issue that brought me in was the experience with my friend, the doctor suffering from Parkinson's disease, who very plainly made it clear to me that he would have welcomed my assistance by providing him at least a haven for his ending his own life. And this happened very naturally and very not unpleasantly in 1977, 3 years ago.
At what point did you think of having some kind of understanding for your own death? At what point did you start thinking about your own death and at what point you would want to perhaps end your life?
Well, I began thinking of an agreement or at least having my wife understand my views and coming into accord with them. The year before Dr. Proctor came to me, and I had actually worked out in draft form an agreement with her along those lines. With Wallace, I worked out a rather simpler agreement because, of course, his situation was plainer and simpler in that it was clear that he would at some time choose to end his own life. Of course, our agreement was couched in terms of mutual assistance, but the probability was that he was the one who would be aided.
Johanna, when Morgan first started discussing rational suicide with you and when he brought up the possibility of you both having an agreement with one another, what were your initial reactions?
Terry, I think there was a time before that I wasn't very happy discussing our own death. I could very easily talk about it in my teaching and with friends or relatives, but to really discuss it together was something that wasn't all that easy for me, as natural as other things come. But I feel, as the years go on, more and more comfortable with it, and I'm very glad, looking back now, that we did that.
I think a lot of people think that it's very morbid to discuss death, particularly to discuss the possibility of your own death and what you would do if you'd get really mm-hmm. sick. Is it morbid, do you think, to discuss it, or has it been morbid for you the way you've been?
I don't feel that now, but I did when I was very young. I was afraid of death. I was afraid that my family would die, my mother, father. Somehow that was very scary, and I surely didn't feel very good in talking about it. Also, I began, as a little girl, we were Catholics, and I remember the threat of hell and the bribe of heaven sort of seemed, at that time, seemed sort of like a good thing when I was little, at least thinking if I was good, I could go to heaven. All of that, of course, has changed over the years, and we have a very different religion now. I forgot what you asked me.
Some people would think that it's morbid to discuss death.
Well, in those years, I guess I felt that. I surely don't feel that anymore now. Not at all. But many people do. And many. Therefore, I think it's so good that there are programs like this, and more is it coming in the open.
We both shared a very long, trying period with a dear friend who was dying from a brain tumor. We went almost daily to the hospital to be with her. There was never any question of her hastening her death, so that our views on suicide never came in at all, when it was plain that she wanted to fight till the very last. But this was an experience that I'm sure prepared both of us for a different way of dealing with an obviously hopeless situation like that was.
Can you share with us how you feel about that sense of hopelessness? You know, I had experience recently where my grandfather was taken to the hospital. And the question came up in the family, how much should we tell him about what he has? If we told him the truth, which was pretty grim, would that detract from his own will to live and the fight that was left within him? And then, of course, the question came up, would we want him to use up all that energy to continue to live when it was going to be a very short and very painful stretch of life that awaited him? Have you figured out for yourself the parameters of like where life is worth continuing and where it isn't for you personally?
Well, of course, the particular situation will always have new variables, I suppose. But I think in terms of the so-called balance sheet approach, which is simply one of where you tot up the points in favor of your continuing to live, the advantages, the sensory enjoyment you receive from life, your response to your family and others, and the things on the other side of the balance sheet that would argue against continuing pain or the demeaning quality of life, pointlessness, tremendous and meaningless financial expense, and so forth. These are all factors that enter in, and they're in different proportions in every individual case.
Well, do you have a personal sense of at what point you would want to terminate life, Johanna, for yourself?
Well, I think I very much feel like Morgan does, that when all the beauty and the enjoyment of life goes out, that there isn't any point. And surely if a terminal illness or any illness for which there is no more cure comes along, I wouldn't want to prolong it myself. And we both have been in nursing homes, and neither one of us would ever want to be in that position.
It's partly a consideration for the other, I think, because we both realize how much it drags down the partner in a couple when one is going through this terrible period.
Yeah, and the whole family, darling.
Surely. But
yeah, but I'm sure at the same time, you would do anything to keep your spouse alive. It must be a very tough predicament to be in when you've both agreed that at a certain point perhaps life isn't worth maintaining. But on the other hand, I think there is that sense in people that you can harbor some hope even if it's really false hope, and that hope keeps you going, and that still there is that sense of presence of that person who you love. They're still at least alive.
Yeah, that may be very difficult if that situation comes and may be so difficult that it might be harder to do than we can say now just to you here.
Can you outline the agreement for us?
Well, it attempts to address a number of possibilities, and that's why it's a fairly complex thing, because at our stage in life, a number of things could happen. We could have a disabling disease that is hopeless after a long period of suffering. we could have a situation where one of us loses mental competency to make the decision, and this is another problem entirely of itself. We would also want to support the other party in in the straight euthanasia approach, which means that you stop the useless measures that doctors may tend to project with you when there's no point to it and when the expense is meaningless. So we've brought all those several factors into a single agreement, which really just expresses the fact that we will try to help the other party in a variety of situations, even if we feel that the law has not yet been clarified in that area. We feel that we have between us the right to assist the other, if that is the wish of the aggrieved party.
Is the purpose of this formal agreement that you have signed in the presence of a notary for the law? Is it so that should this happen, one would be culpable legally? Well, to what extent is it for you personally also to have a formalized means of speaking about it and working through it and getting as explicit and detailed as you can?
Oh, I think we felt it was important mainly for this legal reason that it's desirable for a person who feels as we do to state this publicly, in a sense, as far in advance as possible, so that there's no hint that this was an act of a temporary aberration, you might say. So that's very important. We also felt we were plotting new ground here, and I felt that maybe we could induce others, not induce, but others might be tempted to do the same thing, and we wanted to see how it would work out. It's entirely new territory, of course, that we're
Do you know anyone else who has agreements like this?
No, we don't,
no,
frankly
I don't
speaking.
Think so, I don't.
So then, of course, you wouldn't know anyone who'd actually follow through on it.
No. Well, this is a private and lonely sort of thing.
What does the law say now?
The law says that if you assist a person to commit suicide, you're culpable. The main problem is that it doesn't say what assistance is, what constitutes assistance. And this is one of the things, and one of the reasons why I'm doing what I am, in a hope that gradually the legal authorities will see that the law should be more clear-cut, or somewhat more clear-cut. It can never be absolutely clear. But literally, it's difficult now for anybody to know in any given state just how far he may go in assisting a person, as I did my close friend. I would like to have known in advance that what I was doing was perfectly legal, but I had no way of finding that out, and therefore I was in 2 months of great uncertainty until it was clear that I was free.
I think many people have experienced being called into the room by their parents, and you expect it's going to be about something very mundane and ordinary, and suddenly your parents sit you down and start telling you, look, if one of us dies or if both of us die, these are certain things that you should know about. And it's, I think, a very uncomfortable time when the children and the parents get together and talk about the possibility of the mm-hmm. parents' death. When you had drawn up this agreement, did you talk to your three children who were, I believe, all adults?
Yes.
And tell them the specifications of it?
Not quite as officially as that, Terry. I do remember a conversation with our two boys, Eric and David, who were really their reaction was sort of negative, that I remember. And why would you want to help somebody else die? And I don't want you to die. You know, they were still, as much as they are adults, they had all the hang-ups, I think, that many real adults, older adults, have now. But I also, we felt, as we've done with our children and as much as possible, we needed to be, to level with them and be open and maybe they could gradually develop the acceptance that we now feel very much ourselves. Our daughter is the youngest of the three, and in some ways I think she can grasp it better. And I think she could even maybe help us. You know, if necessary, that one of us had already died and the other one needed help. I'm not sure that she wouldn't be the one to be able to come forward, although she's never said as much as that. But
I think it's like a reflex in a way. If someone in your family starts talking about their own death or possible suicide, for you to say no, don't do it, and let's not talk about
That's the reflex of society, unfortunately. Suicide is something to be prevented.
Yeah.
And yet, what I'm trying to establish is that there are a few cases, a certain number of cases, that should not be prevented, should be understood, and should be accepted.
Let's maybe try to delineate that a little bit and get a sense of what that difference is between a suicide that you would discourage and one in which you feel like it's definitely a person's right and perhaps a good thing for them to choose.
I feel it's largely a question of age. In other words, I don't hesitate to talk about our agreement, about our views, and my willingness to advise a person, if they're over 60, we'll say. For anyone younger than that, I think it's quite another problem, and I think that's where the suicide prevention people, the psychiatrists, perform a real role, which we don't pretend that that's not right for them. But we'd like to have them understand that there are persons like my friend and the others that I've been associated with and even whose deaths I've experienced, where it was so clear that this was the way for them and this was the way for their families. This was the reasonable way for society. And some of them are thinking of all those other parties.
Okay, so you're not an advocate of suicide. You're talking about a very specific situation that older people would find themselves in.
It's a small group. It's not a mass movement, and I'm not trying to argue anybody into this. I just am willing to help anybody who has come through the decision, has made the decision for themselves, virtually, or wants to be prepared to act as we do.
Johanna, you spent many years teaching at the Rose Valley School, and you were working with very young children there. Mm-hmm. As you and Morgan started to discuss death and American attitudes towards death and your own personal ways of addressing it, did that change the way you would deal with your students, with the children who you were teaching, if one of their pets died or if someone in their family died? Because that's something that I think faces a teacher.
Terry, I can only think that it helped me in my teaching because it deals with your own feelings. And if you can work through that yourself, you can help the children with their feelings. And fortunately, in this good school, I want to give it a little plug because the feelings are dealt with. The whole person, the whole child, from as soon as they come there, which is 2.5, 3 years old, it's not just the development of learning as such, the skills, and that we do too, but the rest of the person is terribly important, and the feelings are dealt with. And so all of this that we were working through enabled me to, I think, do a better job and help the children understand what to accept death as naturally as it should be accepted. Of course, children do that quite naturally. They do a much better job of it. The only thing that isn't good is when they ask questions and the parents or other teachers do not answer them and do not deal with them.
Johanna, you grew up in Holland.
Yes.
Is there a more formalized situation in Holland, or is the nature of death dealt with differently there than it is here? Because you've lived a considerable amount of time in both cultures.
Yes.
And
Terry, I think it wasn't when I grew up there, which goes all the way back to the 30s and 40s. But I do think that the movement of euthanasia in Holland has developed since I've left and has really surpassed us here, and I think even in England. There is a couple in Holland who are very helpful to people who have terminal illnesses and stand by and sometimes provide them with the necessary means. So I feel very enthusiastic about that part.
Morgan, you'll be attending a conference at the University College in Oxford University in England on the right to die. It's a conference on voluntary euthanasia and suicide. What are some of the issues that are being addressed internationally now?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that the the movement outside this country is, to a certain extent, engaged in trying to pull along the movement, the euthanasia movement, with us here, which tends to be held up and hung up on the living will, which is a very fine thing, and I approve of it very much. But I have long felt that the individual should and might want to go beyond it. The English have been amazingly open to that from the very beginning and have tried to get a law through their parliament, not successfully as yet, but they're still trying, which would provide for doctor's assistance. And this is rather unheard of in this country. The legislation that is being worked on here is simply that which will fortify the living will. In other words, allow the doctor to stop his extraordinary measures. But nothing has been worked on in this country with respect to the doctor's active part in assisting a person who wishes to terminate his life. And this is where I'm encouraged by the British, and one reason why I'm happy that this conference is taking place.
I know one of my concerns would be, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, if there was an agreement that doctors could provide the pills used by someone who wanted to take their own life, what would be done to perhaps encourage or push someone towards taking their life in a situation where they wouldn't do it unless they were talked into it? And you can imagine the most grisly situations, the kind that you'd find on, like, in television shows where someone wanted to get the insurance money and they, you know, encouraged someone to swallow a lot of pills and end their life quickly so that they could cash in. That's the real dramatic television program type. Type fare. But then there's pressures work in very subtle ways in families and amongst people who are close, and there's that possibility that you'd never know when someone was manipulated into it and when it was something that they really wanted to do. I'm sure you've given a lot of thought to that.
I don't like the feeling that anybody should feel any social pressure with regard to this. I think some of the people that I'm corresponding with feel that their debt to society is one which is best discharged if they were to take their own lives before a long, long period wherein they're being supported by the contributions of younger people after their own life has become meaningless. But there never should be a social pressure that makes an older person feel, well, I've reached such and such an age and I should think about shuffling off. Not at all. It's up to the individual, and it's a purely personal matter how much life is still meaningful to him or her.
There's going to be a program coming up on public television on June 16th that's going to raise a lot of questions. I think that this is still a pretty new issue to most people. And on here on Channel 12 in the Delaware Valley on June 16th at 8 o'clock, there's going to be a movie screen called Choosing Suicide, and this is going to be a half-hour film about a New York woman named Jo Roman, who is a psychologist and an artist. And she was actually in the process of writing a novel about rational suicide. When she found out that she had a breast cancer, she decided to end her own life. And being that she was an artist and being that she was a novelist on the verge of writing this book and figuring that she wouldn't be able to complete it, she asked a friend who was a filmmaker to come in and document her own suicide and to talk to some friends and family about it. And that's what this movie is going to be, that the documentary of Jo Roman's suicide and of her friends and family's reaction to it. One of the really controversial things about Jo Roman is that this was all done in the anticipation of suffering and helplessness. And at the time that she took her life, the cancer really had not, as far as I understand it, progressed very far. She was still a vital person.
Although the chemotherapy was very, very draining on her, I'm sure of that.
Mm-hmm. You knew her, didn't you, Morgan?
I did. I got acquainted with her. She learned about me after the instance in which I was involved. And we talked about it, and at which time she was thinking in terms of maybe 10 years ahead. It was only later that I learned that she had found she had a limited life to live, and was going to plan then, therefore, for her own action fairly soon. So I lived that through a good deal of that with her.
What were your opinions about whether the timing was right, since she hadn't gotten to that point of suffering and helplessness and did it in anticipation of reaching that, and in fact of not wanting to reach it.
I felt that was entirely her own and her husband's decision. I'm sure they worked it out together, and I wouldn't question what the timing was from her point of view.
On June 16th at 8 o'clock, a lot of people are going to be having their first encounter with rational suicide through this film. Do you think her story, none of us have seen the movie, none of us sitting here, but do you think her story is a fair representation of rational suicide the way you'd like it to be depicted now to people who are really unfamiliar with it as an issue?
Well, I think that Joe Roman, as an artist and a writer, made something of it that meant a great deal to her, but is not necessarily meaningful to the rest of us. I've partaken in the death of a woman who was much less flamboyant, you might say, in the whole procedure, and for whom it was a very, since she'd so long dwelt on the idea that she wanted to do this, was clear in it, that there were no trappings whatsoever. She took her pills with her two of her family standing by and myself without any hesitation. And this is the other way to do it. Dr. Proctor was entirely unemotional in the whole proceeding. It depends on the individual. Joe Roman was a different person, and her death suited her own temperament.
Yeah, I think being an artist, that she wanted her death to be a statement of her art, and therefore documented it. I guess that is a pretty unique situation.
She felt she'd like to make a statement, and this may be understandable in the early days of this sort of thing, but hopefully a time will come when this is accepted more readily, and we don't feel that that the effect on others is as important as what we do with our own lives and that of our close family.
Many people would have religious reasons why they wouldn't
want to do that.
Not only wouldn't want to do it, but probably wouldn't condone it for others either. Yeah. You're both Quakers. Yes.
Yes.
Does the Quaker tradition say anything to you, pro or con, about the taking of one's life?
I don't think that there's any injunction. Quakers' beliefs are not hard and fast. There's little dogma to Quakerism, and we've found in our Quaker community a general understanding of our views, with some exceptions, obviously, for people who didn't feel that was their own particular idea. But there was no religious injunction for or against, and that I like to live with.
You've probably run up against people, or if you haven't, I'm sure you will in the near future, who really would like to stifle the whole movement because of their own religious views.
Yes.
Has that happened yet?
I've only seen that at a conference in San Francisco of the movement, of the euthanasia movement, conservative as it is and was in that particular conference, and yet it was being picketed by Right to Life people who were raising such a hubbub that many of the people thought the conference might be cut short, couldn't go ahead. And the word suicide hardly appeared in that particular conference. That was only talking about the living will. And yet there was this emotional opposition, which is difficult for me to understand.
That's interesting. So for that conference, it was the same people who were against abortion who were also trying to prevent the discussion of euthanasia
apparently,
and rational suicide.
Apparently. Although I should think that it would be far better to keep those two issues quite separate, suicide as distinct from abortion. I don't think anything is served by combining them in a single belief.
What do you feel is their motivation, the people who are actually organizing against this?
It seems to me that they're trying to argue that the individual doesn't have the right, doesn't have any right of self-determination. Of course, their birth is so different from death in this respect. That's why I feel it doesn't serve any good purpose to bring them together.
Johanna, have you dealt with any people who were adamantly against this yet?
No, except from what we've seen on the television shows and from what we know. And when you mentioned Holland, Terry, a little while ago, I think religion entered into it there very much. The Dutch are, you know, either very Protestant or very Catholic. And so, and yet, now they have the euthanasia movement, which is ahead of us here. But I don't think personally I have encountered it. Of course, Morgan has been in this a little bit more for a few years and has been much more active than I have.
So. My experience really comes from the responses to the publicity about my case and the article that appeared in Psychology Today in early 78. I went to some trouble to tally and to examine about 85 letters that were sent either to Doris Portwood, the author of the book, Common Sense Suicide, to the magazine, or to me, as one named in the article. And of a total of 85, about a quarter only were against. Well over half were in favor of the idea, felt that the individuals were doing the right thing. And then there was a small neutral or uncommitted group. But the sentiment was to me gratifying in that it supported what we were doing. I've read many letters against, eloquent and religious and on all points of view. I respect those points of view, but they're not mine.
Morgan, what would you like to see in this country as far as laws and also as far as helping groups, individuals and formalized groups that you could turn to?
I'd like to see what I've been doing, more or less as a lone individual here, with four cases in the past and with several ahead. This to be done by individuals all over the country. It's rather silly that I, with my age and so forth, should be doing this for people all over the country, in a sense, whereas it should be done locally in support groups that can deal with an individual situation much more capably. The other thing is to clarify the laws of the various states so that an individual can know in advance what I'm agonizing with a couple where both are agreed that this should be done in the case of the woman, also with Parkinson's disease. And yet they are talking it over with lawyers and not getting anywhere. And I've told them all along that it really was a waste of time because lawyers in this issue are unable to tell them how far the law goes and how far they may act and where they should stop.
Our listeners may be wondering, since we've spent the last 35 minutes talking about death, if you are both obsessed with death and if you sit around talking about it all day at home.
No, not exactly, Terry. I think we lead a very active, normal, good life, or maybe that isn't the right adjective to use. We both are very involved with our Quaker meeting groups and helping with social issues, peace issues. We both are very fond of tennis. Morgan is a better tennis player than I am, but we spend quite a bit of time doing it, either together or with others. We love nature, we love people, we try and be helpful neighbors and helpful friends in many respects. We see a lot of our family, and we travel a lot. And I don't know if this is a good time, but I'd love to tell you what we're heading for in the coming week.
No, I was just about to ask you about that, yeah.
we are heading for California, where there's going to be an opening of an exhibition of my father, artist father, father's work that we've been helping to bring about for the last three years. It's 3 years ago that I talked to the curator there, who was an admirer of my father's work, and that has kept us really very involved these last years. As a matter of fact, I stopped teaching partly because of that. I wanted to do that before we both were too old or sick.
Mention his name.
Sorry, darling. Joseph Raphael is his name, for people who are interested. Unfortunately, we can't promise that the exhibition will come here, but we hope someday to try it. Maybe we can work out an exhibition in Philadelphia. He was an impressionist painter who was born in California but went to Europe as a young man in his early 30s, and that's where he met my mother. He went to Paris and painted in Holland, and in Holland he met my mother, who was a pianist, and they all congregated in a little village at the time called Laren, where next year they're going to have an exhibition of my father's things too. So we're just very thrilled and grateful for that.
Where's the exhibition going to be in California?
Stanford University Museum. And it's a fine center there because father's things were sent from Holland and Belgium to California. And a lot of his work was around the Bay Area, or is around the Bay Area. Good friend of his, and who's unfortunately not here anymore, Albert Bender, was an admirer of the arts, and he was a great friend to Fares and bought a lot of his work but couldn't keep it all because he did this for many artists and gave quite a few of his things to museums, to colleges, and private people, of course. So we look forward to that tremendously. It's been such a build-up.
Yeah, I know you've been working on it for a long time.
And it's been a good project to do together for us. So we're not just talking.
Yeah,
I'm thinking death, fortunately.
I wish I was able to see the exhibit. Maybe it will tour sometime.
If not, we'll have to bring you one.
We should bring some photographs or slides or something.
We do have a lot of slides,
good,
which Morgan
good.
Took. Beautiful collection.
You know what I'd like to just ask before we conclude this discussion? If someone who's been listening to our discussion of rational suicide wants to either find out more or just sit and talk with some people about it, are there any groups or individuals who can be contacted? Or
there's a small group here, and I think that if they wanted to write to you and you forwarded it to me, I would see that somebody could talk to them.
Okay, so let me give the address here at WUHY. So if you'd like to get in touch with any of these people, I'll forward your letter. So you'd be writing to Fresh Air at WUHY, Independence Mall West, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, 19106. So again, that's Fresh Air, WUHY, Independence Mall West, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, 19106. And I'll forward anything that you send to Morgan Sibbett. I'd like to thank both of you very much for being here.
Yes.
And good
so
luck.
Pleasant.
Good luck with your trip to California and the art show. And thanks again. I've been talking with Morgan and Johanna Sibbett, who live outside the Philadelphia area. They're both Quakers. We've been discussing rational suicide and the movie that we mentioned called Choosing Suicide, which is about Joe Roman, the 62-year-old New York artist, will be broadcast on Channel 12 here in the Delaware Valley June 16th at 8 o'clock. And that's going to be followed up with a half-hour panel discussion representing many different points of view on the subject of rational suicide.